This is Family Electric Ghost, and we are live on our Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, and Twitter channels with Shadow for the first time from Shadow Music. We're glad to have you on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, brother. I look forward to the chat.
Well, we want to tell everybody we do have a sponsor. We're on Newsly and Newsly.me. It's another podcast app, so it's going to take this podcast and translate it so you can listen, and you can stop scrolling, start listening. Yeah, 1 month free premium subscription if you use Ghost2021 as the coupon code. So use Ghost2021 as the coupon code. Go to iOS or Android store and check out Newsly. We're going to be on Newsly within an hour with this podcast. So thank you very much for being on the show again. And we like to get into kind of like a behind the music type of interview, because like we've always liked, you know, that kind of depth. So usually the first question we always ask a musician is like, when did you get into music? Do you remember what age you got into it?
Man, that was like probably around 7 or 8, I would say. But like, I was always like listening to old records and stuff. Like my parents, my dad used to always listen to like Ronnie Laws and Stevie Wonder, like we were saying earlier, Al Jarreau. Mm-hmm. And so I was a little kid. I was, you know, probably earlier than 7, probably like 5 or 6, listening to those records. And got my first saxophone when I was probably like maybe 13 or 14. And I started on clarinet. Now that I think about it, like clarinet was like
the it first
was
one.
Yeah, that was like officially the first one. That at school, like we were playing band at school and stuff. That was like middle school, right before high school. And
I mean, I got a recorder and then I jumped to clarinet because I said, this recorder, I don't like it.
Yeah, I wasn't feeling clarinet. But before that, the records that I was listening to, I wanted to play saxophone. So the very first saxophone I got was, we got it at a pawn shop, and I didn't have any formal teachers. It was a guy named Kelvin Easters. He was married to one of my cousins.
Oh, wow.
And so he was like a jazz player.
Oh, so he actually had the background and he was patient enough to teach?
Yeah, so I used to go over his house when I was little, and he used to just say, here, put the record on, slow the record down, and try to copy what they said.
That's the African-American way of learning.
Yeah, put the record on and just try to transcribe it right there and slow the record down. And that's how I got started unofficially. But really, I would say officially, because I mean,
where it starts.
Yeah, that's the real art form, is the jazz stuff. You know, I got classical stuff later. You know, the classical stuff, classical education came later, but really, that was my first start back when I learned from him.
So that's the thing. Like, I grew up as a child of the 70s. I'm 55. My dad had the Chess record collection with all the freaking James Brown 78s. And then he had all this jazz, all Coltrane. He had, you know, Monk. He had, like, everything. And I'm sitting there like, wow. And then he had... Well, I just got kind of a keyboard. He got like Songs in the Key of Life. And then I heard like Saturn and Vintage Ghetto Land. I said, what is that? And then I actually started looking into it. I said, oh, he's using a Yamaha GX1 Dream Machine. And I'm like, yeah, I want to know what those synths are. And I started tracking down what Herbie was playing, all these people were playing, because I wanted to know. That's how I kind of got into it. But yeah, everybody starts like, because I think they love like listening to I think everybody's like a fan, right? You start as a fan first to like in the music, then you become like, I want to try to do that, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. And I tell everybody, like, you know, growing up was rough. I watched my parents like get into a lot of fights. They ended up being divorced, but the only time they was like getting along was when they was listening to the records. So I was like, this brings joy into people's life. So that's motivated for me. Was like bringing joy to people's life. And I remember hearing Rocket by Herbie Hancock, man.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
Yo, like what he was doing with the vocoder. Oh, man.
Yeah. He was so innovative because he had already done done some really funky like work in the mid 70s, like before he even did that. And then suddenly did that and he kind of got into the new wave. He kind of got into the new wave as a jazz player getting played on MTV, you know, during the whole, you know, Duran, Flock of Seagulls type of thing. And he's got pushed in there. And, you know, that was big. It's just as big as Michael Jackson. People forget, like, he was a big innovator on MTV, too. He's a jazz guy showing up on MTV.
Oh, MTV. That's like an inspiration for real right there, bro. That's like
big time. Yeah.
Man, like, if he could do it, I could do it. You see that guy, you're like, yeah, I could do this.
Yeah, because how the heck did he broke through the wall? You know, there's a barrier there, and he got, boom, right through it, you know? People forget about Herbie did that. You know, I remember because I was like, yeah, that's awesome. That's what it should be. So you said you actually got into where you kind of like got your mentor. You were able to get somebody to actually take time to teach you. When so you started, a hint that you got into more formal education. How far did you go with that? You talked about classical.
So yeah, like when I got to high school, that's when I actually got some formal education. I got like an actual like private lessons teacher to teach me how to properly play scales and stuff. But by that time I had already learned by ear a lot of stuff. And then I worked on piano a little bit. I got a little bit of private lessons with piano, but I was like solely focused on saxophone. It was so hard to like focus on piano and saxophone at the time in high school. Mm-hmm. So I was like more focused on saxophone and you know, marching band, symphonic band.
Yeah, I did the jazz band, the marching band, the concert band, you know, orchestra, because I like the fact that I was learning how to, you know, I like to learn to sheet read, you know, but then when I switched to piano, I kind of dropped off of sheet reading and went to like playing by ear. Because like I knew the treble clef, I didn't know the bass clef, because I was like, what's that? So I just like, okay, I'll just learn the chords. So I just started learning the chords and then listen and stuff. And then it's like, I started picking it up. But, you know, that's how people learn, I guess.
Yeah, it's always a mystery, man. Like trying to figure out a good balance of reading sheet music and playing by ear, because it feels like the sheet music slows you down a lot.
That's what I found. I let it go.
Because like when you're on the stage and you're on the spot, you don't got time to really read no sheet music unless you're in the pit.
Yeah, I mean, think about like James Brown or even Hendrix. Oh. Hendrix was, he wasn't doing the sheet.
James Brown was like, if you got time to read sheet music, you can fire.
I would listen to the tapes and he's actually, you know, singing the drum lines. He's like actually telling a drummer what to play. People are like, he's like Michael Jackson, you would do that. He's famous, there's a video of Michael telling people what to do with his voice. So he's actually writing out the bass line with his voice, telling a piano player with his voice. And James was doing that. I think Michael picked up on that from James. If you listen to the rehearsal tapes, which I got tons of those, he's doing that like everywhere. You know, he's telling everybody what to play. So he really knew what he wanted, you know.
Yeah. And then you had the classical guy with the guy on trombone who was the band leader for James Brown band. He used to be the one that was brave enough to tell him, okay, James, that's not going to work. It ain't going to sound right, but we're going to see what we can do. And I mean, you listen to him playing the song, man. Like one of my favorite songs is Paid the Cost to Be the Boss.
Oh, that one. Fantastic.
He said, go to the turnaround. You don't know when he's going to say it. That ain't on no sheet music. He gonna just
he just does it. Yeah. He has those shoes like you missed a cue, $50.
Yeah. He's like, you don't know you gonna say it on bar one or bar four or bar 15. But as soon as you say hand for the turnaround, your ass been a hand for the turnaround.
Prince picked up on that. And if you ever watch Prince live, he used to do that. He used to, with his band, he would like throw the turnarounds anywhere.
Yeah,
he'd just throw things. He'd have like keywords. And then that would mean you have to go into this phrase that they rehearsed, and then you would just say it. He was like, boom. Then he would just bounce it around and keep on saying these key phrases that, you know, nobody knew what it meant. Because he had this phrase called ice cream.
Yeah.
And he would say ice cream, and suddenly it would go into this different section that they rehearsed, and then he would jump out of it. And they were like, that's pretty cool. I thought it was cool. But
it reminded me of the Dave Chappelle episode where he was on there. Anybody want some pancakes?
Yeah.
Computer blue.
So when you started to get into writing, So is that why you wanted to get into the piano, so you could have like a writing instrument on top of your like kind of lead?
The piano, I want to learn piano just so I can understand the chords better and just have like a structure of like when I'm laying down ideas. Piano is really good. And
A
also
good bridge.
understand the bass clef too, because I was reading treble clef as a saxophone player, but I didn't have no idea about bass clef. And using two clefs, I need to know how to read that. So the piano was good.
That's why I got into it, because like it's like you either get an acoustic guitar and use that to write a song, or you use a piano. And then I said, well, I couldn't afford a piano, but I could actually find a Roland. And then I got my Roland like a Juno, and then I realized I could play everything because I was in a band. And then I got people stopped showing up, and I said, well, I can do the bass, I can do the drums, I can do all the things. And because I've been a clarinet player, I knew, well, I can't keep on playing this like horn and acting like I'm not breathing, because like if you want to make it sound like a wind, you got to put the breaths in, you have to put the breaks in, or it's going to just sound like endless playing.
So you'd be the one man band with the sequencers, change
I mean,
the
the sequencers, and then I just started doing it. But I know, I think it really taught me how sound structure once I got the synth. And it coming from a woodwind, it was fantastic to be able to do the bass clef and the chords. And then I kind of knew what the lead should be, and then I just, went from there. But I think it's interesting that when you start to write, what made you feel like that you could write your own songs? Because there's a lot of people who are into music and they don't always write their own songs. How did that start for you?
I just was experimenting. Like, I wasn't ex afraid to experiment, man. So when I started writing my own songs, I was still in the army band. I was still overseas in Japan when I was stationed in the army band over there. And I was working with a Japanese group, and the leader of that group was a piano player. And he was like, try writing out this line right here. And I would try it. And that's what I was learning. That's what I was cutting my teeth and learning how to use Pro Tools for the first time. I was over there. And so I was like, okay, I see these guys using Ableton Live, Pro Tools, and these guys don't know how to read music, but they're producing tracks as producers. I'm like, let me take a stab at this. And then it started off with learning how to use the DAWs, like Pro Tools and stuff, and stacking tracks. And then I wanted to get more details, so I was like, no, I want to play the line like this, so let me write it out. Then I went to try to learn what's that like Band in the Box. I was on
Oh yeah,
Band in the Box,
garage band type of thing.
GarageBand, GarageBand, Band in the Box, and there's another software called like Sibelius or something like that, where it'll do the sheet music for you.
Oh
And
yeah.
so
You're a
so
transcriber.
yeah so you just sit there, you just point and click and put the notes in there. And I was like, oh, I just wrote something, you know what I'm saying? And you
And once
learn,
you can write your own stuff, you can run everything.
and then you just play around. I even tried like getting like manuscript paper and writing down the notes. Now that should take forever. But like,
I
with
tried that back
technology.
in the late 70s. I used to do that, and then I got my first, like, I got a Tascam 4-tracker, and then I got a chord sequencer, and I had a Roland D5. And I said, well, I'm not doing that no more. I just opened it up, and I was watching Frank Zappa. He was talking about, like, you know what? I just record all my concerts, and they go back and they listen to them, and they find the songs. I said, well, that's a cool idea. So I just do it like an open rehearsal, do like stream of consciousness, and then put things down, and then go back and try to find the things that were cool, and then work on those. That's kind of my tendency, what I do. But
Hey, I'm about to try that. I never tried it like that. I got to try that.
it's a cool technique, because Prince used to do it, like the Allman Brothers did it, like a lot of old classic bands, Neil Young, Crazy Horse, they would just go in and just put it down on a reel, and then go back and say, hey, that's the groove, that's the song, and then work on it. And it's kind of it gives you have all this like artifact material. It's like, what was that groove we did last week? And it's like, we'll take that and pop this in there. People do that now with their, the Ableton and Live and stuff, but people used to just go on their boards with their reel to reels and grab the stuff, everything, and they just record it. It's always a workable way of doing it.
That's dope. I like that.
Yeah, it's old school. I mean, I'm still old school.
Man, but, analog is great, bro. Analog.
Yeah, well, you're analog all the way on the sax.
Yeah, you can't get it's no more analog than that.
Yeah, that's the real deal. My Moog is, you know, I feel really good with my Moog when I see these kids on the CDJs, and then I'm actually playing my Moog. But then you know, I see that guy on a guitar or a sax, I was like, yeah, that's real. You know, that's even more real than what I'm doing.
Yeah. You can't get around it.
So you use like your audio interface to bring your sax in. So do you have to find different kinds of mics that capture your sax? I would always wondered with sax players, like, how do you choose the mic to capture your sound?
I like when I find a mic, I just stick with that one. So I got an AKG clip-on mic right now, and I've been using it for years. And
you like it? You like how it sounds?
Yeah, it's clip-on. It's not a wireless. It's a wired mic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wired's kind of way to go.
I use that one for like a lot of home studio stuff. But when I'm at a real good studio, mm-hmm. any type of really good condenser microphone.
Yeah, if they have those like $5,000 condensers and $10,000, then you can just use those.
Yeah, that's like omnidirectional.
Yeah.
Hey, it catches everything, bro. It catches everything. The highs and lows.
The studio mic's always I think I got my nice mic, and then I hear there's like this guy's got like a $10,000 mic, $20,000 mic. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
But that's why it's a studio.
But if I got like if I'm like at a stage setup, I like using not Shure's, but it's another company called it's a mic called the M1 Sennheiser.
Is that Sennheiser? I use those. I've used those before. Are those wireless? Is that your wireless one?
No.
You're still wired?
I'm still wired with the Sennheiser. It's on like if we do like a big band style with all the saxophones lined up, you know?
Okay, so it's still like wired.
Yeah, so Sennheiser, it's like an M58, I think is what it's called. M48.
Yeah, I used like a headset from them because I wanted to be able to move around my rig, and then I kept on not being able to get to my mic, and so they made a really good wireless that you could actually capture vocals. So I know who they are. They're pretty good mics.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I always like, you know, drummers are always talking about how they mic their kick drums, and they have to mic the set a certain way, and it's different producers have different ways of mic and stuff, and you say, okay. You know, you learn from the producer. So did you ever like deal with a producer that kind of taught you like different techniques?
Yeah. There was a producer in Japan, the same one. I learned most of my stuff from him. John, that's his first name. He was from Full Sail. He learned from Full Sail. So he taught me a lot of different biking techniques for saxophone. Like there's one way you can do two mics. Like you have one aimed at the bell, and then you have another one aimed at the upper stack where your neck is.
Oh wow. Both.
Yeah, you get like a stereo recording.
And did he multi-track it on separate tracks? Each of those is on a separate track?
Yeah, he can do it both ways, having a left and right, or just have them both
centered on the same channel. Yeah
or different channels depending on if you want to mix the sounds, because you can mix the two different microphone sounds and create a really good stereo effect if you stack it, you know.
Yeah Because if you separate it, like I've gotten into, I have, when I first started, I didn't do a lot of separation in my mixes. I got later I started like separating all my keyboards, so every one of them is on a different track. So then when I go in, I can like move them around, and some of them are like left and right. And so I got like two channels and like move them around. So I find the more channels you have with like each instrument discreetly on it, then you can do a lot when you start to master and remix and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That gives you more room to play around with. No doubt. For sure.
Do you like to like overdub, like, like do like overdubbed layered saxophone lines, like you're doubling or tripling or adding different variations so you sound like you're a choir of saxophones? Do you do that kind of thing?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, hell yeah. The Bitcoin Millionaire track, I stacked them saxophones, like, cause on that song, I'm doing vocals, but you know, the primary thing is the vocals, but I did the saxophone and I stacked them bad boys and it sound good, nice and thick. Yeah. Everybody playing the same line, but it's just me double, you know, I dub, overdub, overdub like 4 or 5 times. And yeah. It's just nice fat sound.
That's a classic thing, because Stevie Wonder, before the polyphonic synths, he used to take like a Moog, or he used to take an ARP 2600 and actually stack the notes into chords separately. Actually, I saw a review of like Songs in the Key of Life. He said, well, this thing wasn't polyphonic, so I had to go and overdub the chords one note at a time on separate tracks.
Wow.
And he just had the patience to actually do it. And until we got the Dream Machine, which was polyphonic, and then he was able to do Saturn and stuff on that, because he actually could do four, you know, two-handed chords on it. That's why Saturn sounds the way it is, because it's like a polyphonic analog $300,000 Dream Machine GX1, which it doesn't sound, there's nothing that sounds like that again, because he got Barry Gordy to buy this $300,000 synth for.
Yeah, Stevie Wonder is the man. If he say do it, you just say yes.
You know, the Gordy was like, you need that one? He's like, yeah, I need that one. That's the one I need.
Yeah. Like, how much you need? Yes.
That's it. Yes. No question. That's the one you're getting.
how many sales? Yes.
That's it. Well, it's a classic. Then there were only 10 of them like built. And like, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer had one. The guy from Yes had one. And Stevie had one, you know. So it's all the big, big synth players, the guys in Genesis, you know, all the big synth bands. And Stevie's like, I'm going to have one too. You know, and then not just the rockers are going to have one. I'm going to have one. He's like, you know, people are like, he's a rocker. And Stevie Wonder's album is like progressive rock and funk and soul all at once.
All that, man. Gosh, such a genius. He's such a genius.
Yeah. I mean, you got to look at, you know, if you're learning, I had to look. I don't get anywhere near where he is, but you're like, you have to look at it. You have to listen to it. If you're going to learn how to play a synth, you got to listen to Stevie, because like that's, he really shows you how to do it if you listen. But so like when you were listening to people coming up, like those records you were listening to, like, can you kind of tell people more about the sound that you were influenced by and maybe your heroes or people, your reference points?
Say that again.
Like when you're coming up and listening and you're like, as an artist, who were the people that you were the most inspired by as a sax player, or who were musicians that do what you do? Like who were your big inspirations? Like what musicians besides Herbie and other people we mentioned?
Michael Brecker, Jay-Z, Pharrell Williams, John Coltrane, Prince, Michael Jackson, Aaliyah.
Mm-hmm.
Janet Jackson, Chaka Khan.
So it's a mix of everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Snoop Dogg, U2, Pantera, yeah. Van Halen.
Yeah, you're expansive. That's what I call my sound expansive, because like I got punk in my spray. I got some Living Color. I got some Clash, you know, I got some like, you know, Joy Division, New Order. Because if you're going to get in the new wave, you're like, you're going to pull in like Joy Division, New Order, Depeche Mode, those kind of Duran Durans. But then you're going to go back and listen to Funkadelic and Bernie Worrell. Yeah. And Bernie Worrell, you know, he's a genius. And like he took all that funk that those guys were doing. And, you know, he actually had the Berklee degree. And he was actually teaching those guys how to structure. You know, Bootsy was amazing, but he's the one that knew how to do the, you know, songwriting. He had the classes. He knew what to do, and so he helped like compose everything. And then he just knew how to play the mini Moogs and the Hammond B3s and all the, everything. He could play all that stuff.
Yeah, Bootsy Collins.
Yeah, Bootsy. Bootsy on the bass is like, he was with James, but then James kicked him out because he said he wasn't disciplined.
Oh, you remember the Brothers Johnson with Quincy Jones? Oh yeah. Man. Don't like they call him the hitman. Because they used to be the Motel studio musicians for every track, everything.
Like the Funk Brothers, yeah, those guys, like they laying down everything, along with Smokey. You know, Smokey's like writing everything, and then the Funk Brothers like playing everything.
Man, the way they did the Jackson 5 track, Displaced Hotel. We did a live version of that in Japan. That song is just magical. Bro, that's
all that Motown stuff, and just like listen to like to the Percy Shuffle. You know, if you listen to just the tambourine, right? They had a guy I was watching a documentary. I forget his name. That his expertise was to add the tambourine on like all the tracks, and he used to have this unique way of playing a tambourine. If you listen to Motown tracks, there's always like a track with the tambourine. They had this guy, a percussionist, that was like amazing. He found all these different ways to actually use the tambourine that I didn't even imagine you could do. And he used to do it, and he would always layer it like it would be a separate track on almost every Motown song. If you go listen, you can hear him doing that tambourine track, which is really weird, but not weird, but it's just a secret sauce to their sound. It's like embedded in the Motown sound.
Yeah, every little bit, a little bit go a long way.
Yeah, you never know. It's like how much like just something like that is like core to people actually picking up on that rhythm. You know, which is like infection. but you have a term here, the shadowy riders army. Will you tell us about that? What's that?
That's my fan club. That's so fan club. You know, yeah, Shadow Riders Army. That's this right here. This logo right here.
Oh, that's what that is.
Yeah, this is the Shadow Riders. This is the Shadow Riders Army logo right here. So my fans, man, that's a long story. So Shadow Riders used to be a car club. It started out as a car club in Japan. So those guys that was in that car club supported my music. So wow. I used to be like, I still am very much into like JDM car culture. And I used to go and like, go to a garage where Japanese guys hung out at and work on my car on the weekends and sometimes in the evening.
Those all Skyline GTRs?
Yes, GTRs, yeah. Hondas, Toyotas, different.
Different the high-end ones, the Japanese-only models, like the crazy ones that we didn't get.
Oh, yeah, right-hand drive the whole nine, man. So we were in Japan. And they saw how dedicated I was with working on my car that they adopted me into their crew.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we started a car club called Shadow Riders. And then I kept it going. And it eventually turned into my fan club. But I wanted to keep the car club part as its own, you know. Own thing. So for the fan club, later on, I just added Shadow Riders Army, because you know you got Beyonce Army, Justin Bieber Army, you know, all these
Kiss Army.
Yeah. So I got Shadow Riders Army. So that's what that is.
That's interesting. Cause I actually lived in Japan from 2004 to 2006. I was doing business there. And I lived in Tokyo. I lived in Moto Azabu near Roppongi.
We used to go down there to hang out, bro, right around that time.
I had a little condo in the middle of I was in Moto Azabu, right in the middle of Roppongi, but you know, near Shobusho, like a fire station. I loved the Japanese people. I loved it in Japan. I remember going to like Roppongi and just seeing like nightclubs, and there were guys in there channeling Coltrane, and there were guys in there doing Motown. There were guys doing like punk rock, like the Japanese, and they would do it in their own way. Like, so they weren't biting off. They kind of reinterpret it and get their own flavor on it. And I was just amazed about how it was really dynamic. I would go to clubs and just watch what they were doing because I was just really interested.
Yeah, they're so dynamic and so creative. It's like that whole country is like a bed for creativity and inspiration and art. Like everything is artistic. And they like, how they look at music and the arts is totally different. They look at you as like a Buddhist monk or something because you study the arts.
Yeah, you get more respect for, I found, because my daughter went to a Japanese preschool and kindergarten, and she to this day uses Shinto culture to inspire her art. She's actually a graphic artist, and she, because we lived in Japan, her whole, she's an African-American artist that has like a Shinto Japanese motif, and people see her art and they think she's like a Japanese artist because she was influenced by it, and it's still like a hardcore part of her work, which is really cool. It's a kind of interesting dynamic, and I thought, you know, it's cool that I was able to give her that. But yeah, it's like cool to see that she picked up on it.
Yeah, it does really grow on you, bro. I want to go back.
I've been wanting to go back for years.
Yeah.
It was in 2006. I was like, I hated to leave. I wanted to stay. My company said, oh, you got to go. And I'm like, you're done. I was like, I don't want to be done.
Yeah, I want to stay. Let me stay. I'm going to go back, bro.
I will go back because I'm actually working with a Japanese producer. So I'm hoping I get to go to Shinjuku because that's where the studio is. And I actually do something with her. But yeah, I just find the artists there is just fantastic, from the musicians to the painters, to the, you know, the videographers and pictures and anime and manga, all that stuff. I'm just totally enveloped in it. But the other thing's kind of cool that you're into is NFTs. And can you tell us about how you got into that?
Oh, yeah. So I really got into it last year, like 2001, like around this time, about October. I started seeing all the headlines on it. The artist that had a real big impression on me was Tory Lanez, because Tory Lanez got on there on Instagram and made this big announcement that he sold 1 million NFTs to 1 million fans for $1 each. And then those fans turned around and sold those individual NFTs for like $5,000 each. Some of them sold them for $50,000, $60,000 each. And this is for like, so each one of the NFTs was an EP, was like a album with a couple of songs on it.
Oh, wow.
And so they flipping them for $50,000, $60,000. And I saw that. I was like, oh, I got to get on this.
Yeah, because that's better than getting paid on Spotify.
Oh, hell yeah, bro. Getting paid a fraction of a penny for a stream.
Yeah, 0.06 of a penny versus like NFT. I think I'm going to go NFT.
Hell yeah. And so to this day, like the most I made 400 tezos on one NFT with a collaboration with two other artists. Mm-hmm. So 400 tezos is equivalent of about $630.
Mm-hmm.
Off of that's one more, song.
That's more than Spotify.
Yeah. For one song.
Yeah.
Well, it was just one copy.
World. Well, that's the new world, because like people got like the thing about music, I always ask people, is like, you got to get into sync licensing, you got to get into crypto, you got to get into NFT, you got to find a way to get on TikTok to get the kids to into you. Well, that's a whole different thing, because you have to learn how to get them to, you know, to make yourself work there. It's like you can't just go and present yourself like you do on a music video. You got to like change your image to get on there. But yeah, you just got to, you know, that's how I started getting into video games and trying to do advertising and trying to do like TV and film scoring, because that's the only way you're going to really get anything, because other than playing live, you know, because they don't really pay for our music.
Yeah.
It's kind of devalued ever since Napster and iTunes, and everybody started going streaming, and then boom, like we lost like from 99 cents for a song to 0.06 of a penny for one song.
Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy.
Immediate devaluation of music.
They killed it.
Yeah. It's really cool that people in Japan and people in Australia can hear you, but then they can't, you don't get paid that much for it.
Yeah, you still gonna starve if you just depend on that one stream of income.
You gotta try to see, well, how can I get a booking agent to get me to my fans in Australia and actually play a show? You know, how can I get to Iceland and Netherlands to actually play a show? Because then that's where I'll make the money, you know?
Right. And your numbers gotta be good enough for them to even pay attention to you. You gotta get high enough numbers.
Yeah, you gotta get a high enough number. You gotta get some kind of buzz. So, you know, on SoundCloud or someplace, so you can get a booker they at least can put you on a like a collective, can put you into a collective type of festival type of situation. So you at least can be on stage with a bunch of people and kind of start rolling that way.
Yeah. It did. Have also you done, your like, merch. Festival?
Yeah, merch. Well, merch is the other leg. You know, that's like you see me, right? Well, I'm like, what's this?
Yep. Same here. Merch, baby.
Yeah. Well, that's I make more money on this than any of my songs.
Ain't that something? It's crazy, right?
It's crazy when you're a musician that my hoodie sells more than my music, but you know, that's the world we live in.
Yeah. So,
you know, that's what you got to do. Like, you do what you do, then they can let me do the music. So, like, yeah, I'm going to do the music anyway, so I might as well try to make something. But yeah, so like, have you been on the festival circuit lately? Because of COVID, I know everybody's been kind of not been able to do it, but have you been able to do it?
Nah, it's been a minute since I've been on any type of festivals. I would love to. So anybody, any festivals that's watching this podcast, man, if y'all want to holler at your man Shadow, hit me up. Holler at my booking agent. Let's get it popping. Yeah. I do have, I'm in dialogue talking about an event in Houston that's going to go down in December. And that's going to be like a big, it's going to be like an NFT and art and music festival.
So you're going to get to play too? You're going to be able to play there?
Yeah. That's the, awesome. That's what we're working on. We're talking about it right now, like what I want. So, to be continued.
Yeah. I mean, I used to play in, you know, 2017, 2016, I would go to New York and Boston and I was able to get where I could. So I got on a hip hop tour and I'm not really hip hop, but I was able to kind of finagle my way onto it. And sometimes you got to like, see it, like if you can stretch it to get in.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I don't know if they're going to really dig me cause I'm not really hip hop. I'm like progressive rock and, you know, and kind of funk. But, you know, the kids got, once I played live, they were into it. So you just got to like, just, you know you're going to kick ass and just go on stage, do what you do. And, you know, they feel, oh, wow, he's actually playing.
Yeah.
Because kids don't see that. So when they see somebody actually coming to play, you can kind of show them something.
Yeah. What I want to do is I want to put together a good, solid, like a full band, man. Like how Trombone Shorty got his band set up, or or how Kamasi Washington and Thundercat got their band set up.
Yeah, like, Thundercat, like that's fantastic. Well, he was able to link up with like Kendrick Lamar, and that and what's cool now is the rappers are actually looking for real people,
real bands. Musicians.
Yeah, they're looking for real bands to back them up. So like, you get the guys like, you know, Kendrick Lamar. And even Kanye West, is that they want to actually do a performance with a real band behind them. That's really cool for the future of music, because they like a lot when they were just doing with the CDJs and the DJs, they said, "Well, where are the bands?" But now they're realizing that they want to mix it, so it's across, which is cool because all the funk guys and all the jazz guys can get back into it.
Yeah, so I'll put that out there. Like, yeah, if you watching this podcast right now, man, I want to put together the Shadow Riders band. So if you play like bass, keys, guitar, drums, horn section, trumpet, trombone, alto, auxiliary percussion, DJ, get at me. If you watching this now, if you listen to this now, get at me. If you want to play, get at me.
I want to do it, but I'm like, I'm booked out for stuff. But yeah, one day maybe we do something. But
man, let's do a record together.
Yeah, well, I don't know you listen to what I do. I do a lot of weird experimental kind of funkadelic type stuff, and then really kind of out there. But if you're into that, so yeah, I'm sure that we could vibe on something, because I'm kind of like the guy. Let's just vibe on it, see what happens. But yeah, I think that's really cool. So when you go to write with other people, are you like primarily in your DAW? Do you actually go and like link up with like what you just described, getting a full band? And when you go to record, do you do the full band kind of recording, or do you come in there with like the Ableton and you know, Pro Tools type of thing, kind of to structure that yourself?
I've went both ways. I've done it both ways. I've went in. Like the first my first ever recorded single, it was with a band. Like, I was in Korea with a Korean funk band, Windy City. Mm-hmm. And their whole thing was all live instruments. And I came in there with an idea on a voice recorder. And we listened to it, and then we just tracked it out, instrument by instrument.
That's the way to do it. I used to do stuff on little Fostex and Tascams and even with a Casio into a Tascam, like do it with like a really cheesy drum off of like a Boss drum machine, like a drum pedal, like a little pedal type of thing. Was like really fundamental. It wasn't an 808, but it would give you like a click track, give you something. And then just having a basic demo, sometimes those can be really good though. You can have something that's super lo-fi, but it kind of tells you where you need to go, right?
Yeah, it's just a starting point. It's all it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And you build on top of it.
And then, like, have something.
Then other times, you know, I come in with a Pro Tools session, you know, and we just start with that. And it's got the beats and, you know, different things like that already kind of mapped out.
You kind of like imagined all the parts, and then people, what I always do, like when I do that, when I've been with bands, like I'll do the bass, but I'm not the best. Maybe I'm pretty good at my Moog. But if somebody comes in there and they can really kick ass on the bass, I was like, okay, you reinterpret my bass line. Yeah, you can change it because like you did a better job than I did. Is that how it kind of goes? Like somebody reinterprets your line and shows you something, you're like, yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah, I'll take the bass. Like, if it sounds better than what I did, hell yeah.
Yeah, you let the I always let the person, like if I did something on an 808 and then a real drummer comes in, and then what they do is this really kicking. But then sometimes it's like if it was a funk, if it was a new wave song, it actually needed that 808 to kind of stay. And so it's like, yeah, maybe you can do something on top of it, but we got to keep that because that's the kind of vibe of the song. So he's kind of make a choice. It's like, do you really use the drum machine because you're trying to do something like that? Or do you want to totally change it, you know?
Yeah, and stuff like that. You know, sometimes it's good to have a different set of ears, like a different producer. Because if you writing it, if you composing it and arranging it, sometimes having another producer there to kind of like give you a accountability check on like, does this really sound dope? You know, it's good. You know,
yeah, because they can come in and like record your thing. Like if you came in and your chords weren't that interesting, they come and kind of Beatle chord it. You know, they kind of use Beatle chords, and then it means they just bring a different flavor to it that maybe you didn't imagine, or they shifted to a different key and say, you know, if you did this, and you, so they take what you do, and I always like producers that take your demo and make it sound better, but don't radically change it, but actually make it the best you possible, right? And it still keeps like your integrity and your individualism, and don't try to turn it into somebody else's track just because that's what's hidden. But they actually take it and enhance it and make it better. What do you feel about that?
That's why I like the Neptunes and Pharrell so much, because they were masters of doing that. They had so many versatile sounds. They had so many versatile tracks that they did with so many artists. And I look up to Pharrell so much because he does exactly that. He don't work with hip hop artists, bands. Yeah. He's worked with No Doubt. He's worked with Chester Fresh, Tyler Creator, Snoop Dogg, Kylie Minogue, just countless.
Yeah, and they still sound like them. You know, he doesn't turn them into an Neptune. He actually just enhances their sound and brings part, you know, he brings what he did with the Neptunes, but he doesn't overpower it and make it totally a Neptunes track, which is, you know, that I think that's a cool way of doing it.
Yeah. So totally, man. Like, I think producers who can do that, who got that skill to keep you like genuine and make you sound like you and keep you sounding like you, they're like a godsend, man. They look golden. You're going to keep them producers around you because they're going to make you better.
Yeah, because you got so many people that are like, they just clone like whatever's kicking in the top 20. And I understand it, and I understand why they do it. But it's like, if you want to create music that's actually going to be long lasting to me, like I'm a big fan of the, you know, my child in the 70s, right? And just listen to the diversity of the music in the 70s, you know, and then you listen, like, maybe there's diversity here if you listen to hip hop and there's certain things happening underground. That's why in this show, I talked emerging and independent artists, because I like to show people that there's stuff going on in top 20, top 100, but where all the underground and indie emerging artists, there's really vital stuff going on. You just ain't paying attention. So that's why I do this show, is to bring artists like yourself out there so people can find you. You know, people can actually hear something and maybe they weren't thinking about.
Oh, yeah. I appreciate you, bro, because it's a grind out here. It's hard to, like, get people's attention away from the top 20, top 40, top 100, because that's what they are. Like, the media, mainstream media, is, like, totally just banging people's head with only that, and it's hard to cut through the noise, you know?
It's hard to cut through. Yeah, I mean, you get things like, you know, SoundCloud, you get the YouTubes, you get the TikToks, where you can get some unknown artist. But, you know, the problem with the TikTok, it's kind of really kind of flash in the can, and it's a lot of comedy. And it's a lot of, that's fine. But if that's not your vibe, like if you're not a comedian, then it's like, how are you going to really kick on that platform? It's like, I don't know if every artist that's out here can do a TikTok. And then if you do that, are you going to get stuck thinking everybody thinks you're Dave Chappelle?
You don't want to compromise your brand.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, to get a million views, if I go and do like a Saturday Night Live type of sketch, am I going to be stuck doing that, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to compromise who I really am to fit in with what the mainstream is doing.
What the trends do, yeah.
I want to keep being me.
Well, that's why I started podcasting. I said, well, how can I still be GOAT, the Phantom? I can be Peg, right? Phantom like a ghost. How can I do that and still exist? And then I found this niche of, like, I love music. I'm a producer. I'm a musician. What if I go in and just show the love by talking to musicians as a musician and see if I can spread the wealth, right? Because if I can create a collective, like I started doing the Bedroom Festival online, because then I can take people that I've talked to and give them a platform so they can play, so other people around the world. So if I get a band that's got 300,000 fans and then they're on my festival, then all the other bands that are there, whether they got 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, those other fans will watch because they say, hey, this is interesting. So you just try to build a communal type of system where people will stay because they go, oh, wow, he talks to all these bands. Maybe I should sit there and watch that.
Yeah. It's like a metaverse festival. It's like you get the Woodstock experience without being there. You get to just watch it online.
Muddy. You don't get muddy. You don't get hit with a rock.
Stuck in the mosh pit.
I was actually there at the Green Day one where they had the Mud Fest.
Yeah.
And they were throwing mud at the band. I was actually in the crowd there. I saw them throwing the mud, and like one kid threw it, and then like 10,000 kids started throwing it. So you got to be careful. Like one kid does it, then 10,000 kids start doing it all at once. It's like, maybe you don't want that. But that was fantastic. But that was like, I was young. I went to that thing and I'm like, I saw Joe Cocker. I saw Nine Inch Nails. It's like Green Day. So all these bands for 3 days. And I was like, I've been a fan. And I'm like, yeah, that's what music is about. It's like actually not just being in one lane. I like being able to, like BBC, you listen to everything, you know? Yeah. And I would, sometimes American radio has not been the best for artists to kind of cut through because they keep on playing the same stuff. Like we need to be more open. So we can have jazz, we can have funk, we can have rock, we have punk, we have everything. Why not? Because people listen to not just one thing. So we need to be able to that's what I try to do with this program is like, I try, bring jazz artists like yourself. And I think it's important to show the diversity because when you write, you described like the artists that you're influenced by, and they were all over the map.
Yeah. I mean, people's perception is easily controlled by the media, and they get just programmed to only like a few different genres. But if mainstream media did like what you said and spread it across the board and had like different genres all the time, then society as a whole would like different genres at the time. But they control it so much to where you can't see all the different genres. So yeah, we have to be that force to fight it, man, and like put more styles of music out there so everybody can hear this. You know what I'm saying? Put in a platform, you know, like a festival platform where you can hear all these different styles of music and you're there because your favorite band is there, but you also get to hear all these other really awesome bands and music artists too.
Yeah, like what Tyler started doing with the Camp Flogna. It wasn't just Odd Future. He went and brought multiple bands. Some of them were punk, some were new wave, some were synth wave. He had like, he wasn't just doing hip hop. He opened it up. They had like this hip hop festival, but it's not just a hip hop. He didn't even call it that because he started bringing like other bands in that had nothing to do with hip hop. And so I think that was my idea when I did my festival. Is like if I interviewed a classical musician and a jazz musician and a guy from Nashville and a band from Germany or Australia, they're all there. And they're all doing multiple things. And it's like, and then people actually would stay because it's like, wow, I don't get to see this. Like, well, MTV used to do that.
Yeah.
They don't do it anymore.
No, they play it out.
They played it out. They do the real life, real world, or maybe the unreal life. But so what's your plan besides the NFTs? Are you working on a new album?
Yeah, so there's an album that I've been working on for years called The Nightfall Suites. I'm still working on that bad boy.
Oh, wow.
So fans, be patient. I'm still working on The Nightfall Suites album. I want to get some more traction on a couple of singles first, and I'm continuing to work on it. And what I might do is start dropping a song a month or a song a week off Nightfall Suites. It just build up to it, and then like once I get enough buzz, hit the road and do shows like the one in December, hit up some festivals, build up some numbers, and with more fans to buy more merch and buy more NFTs, I can afford more recording budget to continue the album and finish it. So
yeah, that's all a good strategy. That's a good strategy. Because I think what was interesting, Hendrix actually had to go on the road to like finish. Well, he was doing Electric Lady, but he was doing a lot of work to try to finish like First Rays and New Rising Sun, which was his unfinished fourth album. He was like touring real heavy to actually get it done. He actually built Electric Lady touring for it. That's how he actually built it. He was actually touring real heavy in Europe to actually fund the building of Electric Lady. So that, I mean, artists have done that all the time, even big guys like that. You have to kind of, you know, go and do the work to get where you want to go. And he wanted to build like the best studio at the time, and he just toured crazy to do it. You know, we have the legacy of that studio, but we don't have him. But yeah, people, you got to push, you know, where you can.
Yeah. So that's the strategy, man. So I want to do a lot of like custom experiences for my fan club in different parts of the world. So I got lots of plans. Like we want to do like pop-up shows in places like India and
oh, that'd be awesome.
Africa, and go back to Japan and do a show, go back to Korea and do a show. I mean, the fans are cool there. Thing.
Yeah. That's an awesome thing, because one of the things I wanted to do with my show is eventually take it on the road. So like when I do a podcast, I actually go to the country where the band is, right? And the idea is I'm floating to sponsors is I take a podcast, a video podcast, I go on the road. I follow an artist when they're getting ready to do their show, or I follow an artist when they're recording, right? And actually do the interview while watching them either going through recording an album or going through getting ready to do a show, and actually, you know, do the podcast in that kind of frame.
Yo, that would be dope.
And then try to get like corporate sponsors to say, hey, that's the kind of thing you should be on MTV.
Yeah, not what y'all playing now.
Not what you're doing now, but what I'm saying, if you guys are listening, I go and do something. I follow Shadow to where he goes. He goes to India. He goes to Japan. I go do the show live where he is, and I could do multiple nights if there are different things going on, right? And so every artist we deal with, we do that. I think that is more entertaining, and actually, like, as a musician and a producer, I think that I think fans will find that interesting because they get to see a band or an artist in their zone, in their creative zone, if you're willing to show it. You know, some artists might not want to be with, like, I don't want to show my secret sauce, but you know, some artists might, you know, I think a lot of artists would be willing to do it, but we'll see.
Yeah. So any companies, big companies that's listening to this podcast, if you cater to digital nomads and people that travel for business, we are people that travel for business. So you should sponsor us. So companies like, I don't know, travel companies like Expedia. If you listen to this, holler at us. We got my man, myself, we could do this thing right. So y'all hit us up.
Yeah,
hotels.
We could be the videography. You know, we could do your day in the life of Shadow Music. You know, we could follow you, do a whole thing, even get a filmmaker to actually turn it into a film. There's a lot of cool stuff you can do. You know, if you can get people to have the imagination to say, oh, that's not a clone of something going on. No, that we want to do something because we think that's cool. It's like, maybe you don't have an example of it. Uh-huh. And maybe you don't want to fund it. Where's the example? The example is that kicks ass and you should do it.
Yeah. A ghost in a shadow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good idea.
Hey!
Yeah. I've been pushing this around. I'm trying to get people into it. I was trying to go after like the alcohol companies, like the Seagrams and all those, because I think they're into that kind of stuff. But we'll see. But So beyond that, what do you think like 2023 is going to be like? Do you feel like you'll have more opportunities? Like it seems like this year in December, cutting into the end of this year, are you feeling confident in 2023 you'll be able to like really be out there more like before the pandemic?
Oh, hell yeah. I got major plans. So I'm planning to sell out on all my NFT projects. So that's going to boost, you know, that's going to give me a lot of income resources to finish that album we was talking about. And if I got to put together my own show, I'll do a show, a big event somewhere in the city. I'll put it on. I'll pay the bill. I get with some corporate sponsors. We do a big show. Spend all the money on getting people to record it. Like you said, take good video, good photo, good promo. Market the hell out that motherfucker. Excuse my language.
Yeah, that's fine.
Push that out there hard. And that's just going to like catapult everything. So that's the plan. And then once we put that show out, people are going to get a piece of that. They're going to want some more. And we're going to start hitting the road off the strip of that and have a good, dope videographer with me on every trip, everything. And we just going to have a strong social media marketing team put together. And take over the internet, man, like Andrew Tate did. You know, Andrew Tate, the guy that's like the masculine guy, he totally took over. His fan base just took over TikTok because they were like reposting his videos. We'll do the same thing. We're going to take over social media.
Yeah. If you need us to do live podcasts when you're doing that, if we don't get our other idea, we will more than willing to do live podcasts with you when you need to. Like if you want to push something out, this platform, you can come to me directly and we can work that out.
Maybe I can talk to the guys that's going to do the show in Houston. I don't know where you're at, but Houston, it's open because they're taking on stuff like that. So, and then like the stuff in 2023, most definitely, bro, I hit you up. And we could just collab.
Because even if we can't do it physically there, we could still do the virtual one as long as you get a connection. We could do it from the venue. So if you want to be able to podcast to like Facebook and Twitch and Twitter live from wherever you are, you know, I could do it on our platforms and push it up on the Spotify and iTunes and all that. But like, yeah, I think what you're doing is really cool. And I love being part of like people who are moving and trying to get something done. So yeah, I think that's where live music and musicians playing music, you know, like Prince used to say, live music, you know, real music by real musicians. that's kind of where my head's at. And I do appreciate that you're out there still doing it. And you know, in a world where the kids, you know, are in the box, it's cool to see people actually, you know, playing an instrument.
Yeah, we got to keep doing it, bro. Because if we do it and we're role models that stand up and do it, there's going to be some kids that see us and look up to us and be like, that's cool. I want to do that. Just like when we were kids.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We got the torch now, bro.
Yeah, get kids on the baritone and sax, you know, and you get the kids on the Moog. You get them playing, like, you know, because like we got to have more funk, you know. You can't just have funk if it's in a box. You got to actually play it.
I already got a few kids that look up to me like that.
That's awesome. Well, yeah, anytime I can, I try to teach kids when I produce, like, you know, to not be scared to touch the Moog. Don't be scared.
Yeah. Experiment.
Don't be scared of all the wires. Don't be scared of the dials. Like, I can't touch that. No, that's how you learn. Like, how you learn is you actually pick it up and you, like, you say, well, I don't know. Like, how does a guitar player learn? They pick that thing up and they actually start getting blisters and they say, hey, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to do it. And I'm not going to go play basketball or baseball or whatever. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to learn that instrument. And it's a discipline. It's like sports. You get muscle memory. You get the experience, a team sport. You know, to me, music is like a team building thing. You have to work with a team. And you have to have communication. If you're in a band and you're with that bass player and you're with that drummer, you're communicating. It's a team effort. And so people need to understand it's vital. And I hate it when people get rid of music programs and they think it's like they can drop it. Kids really need to have other outlets besides sports. I mean, sports is great, but as a musician, we really got to push for kids to be able to learn sax, learn piano, learn guitar, learn violin, you know, because how are you going to create new music if you don't learn it?
Right. Yeah, you got to pass the torch on. You can't hog that motherfucker. You got to pass the torch, man.
Yeah, definitely. So everybody can go to your website that's here and they can see all things Shadow Music, right?
That's correct. This is the next big thing. So Dow Dow is a platform where fans not only can listen to stuff on that link right there, but they can invest in our upcoming shows, technologies, NFTs, and actually own a piece of Shadow Riders Army through the power of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology.
Well, I think that'll get the kids who are into that. And a lot of people are into that today. So I think that's another angle that, you know, I got to look into myself. So thank you very much for being on the program. We're at like the hour mark. And we're very happy that you came here. And we think we'll be able to actually talk to you in the future a lot more than we were even doing tonight. And have a good, safe night. And I wish you the most success you could have. And I hope I can help do something with you in the future to help you push that.
Hey, I thank you very much, my brother. Thank you for having me on the show. And thank you, audience, for having us and all the Shadow Riders Army members worldwide, man. You know what it is. This is Shadow, leader of the Shadow Riders Army, signing off.